You're listening to the Forefront Church Sermon Podcast. Forefront Church is a progressive Christian community more interested in asking good questions than having all the right answers. Thanks for listening.
Forefront for about 8 years. I did some math recently, it was quite a while. I used to be on staff, so thank you so much for having me back here to speak a little bit on a somewhat heavy topic. I'll be speaking about Palestine, and I'm part of Forefront's Palestine Liberation Task Force, and you'll be hearing from more of us later on the service. We'll be presenting parts of a drafted public statement we've done as a church that you can get feedback on after service when we circle up and do the Kinship Cafe. As Kevin mentioned, we are in the season of Lent, and so in the series we've been talking through various disruptions, and we're talking mostly, I think, about kind of personal disruptions or maybe national disruptions, and I think in some ways in the past 6 months we've seen a pretty big global disruption through the current genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. Over 30,000 have been killed, and somewhat unspeakably, especially given how heavy our churches, over 10,000 are children. And a lot of that is funded through our, you know, American taxpayer dollars. And so these statistics can and do feel overwhelming. I want to acknowledge that. And just to acknowledge that sometimes it feels like, you know, you don't know enough to comment. You need like a PhD in this topic to say like one Facebook status or one tweet. And you don't want to offend anyone, so I just don't end up saying anything, and I think that's totally understandable, and that's partly why our task force has kind of gathered to help our church kind of walk through this issue. And I'll say a few things, but you know, just the way that our church works is that you're totally free to disagree with anything I say on stage, honestly anything anyone says on stage, and if you're after this church, you know, debate with me, that's totally fine. But so all I could really hope is that you consider like two things. One is that I think although it may seem like in some ways an issue between like Jews and Muslims, this is an issue that Christians have a lot of stake in. And then particularly Western Christians are argued historically, theologically, and politically complicit in the current oppression of Palestinians. And the second point is that I think we also have a unique capacity and privilege to take sort of bold, risky action in the service of hope. In 2015, I visited Israel with my partner at the time, and we passed by the somewhat innocuous sign that I definitely would not have taken any photos of. I'm realizing this is causing mic feedback, so I'm gonna take this off. But the reason I took a photo of it was because she pointed out, oh, did you know this museum is being built partly on the graves of thousands of Palestinians? It's the largest Muslim cemetery in Palestine, actually including thousands of Palestinian Christians. Pre-Crusades, I believe. And I was like, oh, ironic. I took a quick photo, and I didn't think about it too much. And then, but I want you to keep that photo in mind. I was just going through my Facebook photos, and like, what was I taking photos of and when I went on my trip? And then I took this other photo of these beautiful, gnarled, kind of ancient olive trees. I think this is sort of the alleged garden of here. Like, okay. This is the... allegedly, I take all these with a grain of salt, but allegedly the Garden of Gethsemane. And so, you know, this is where Jesus prayed before he was betrayed by his disciples. I'm sorry I keep getting like that mic thing, but I'll yell at me if you think I should be doing something different. And so this garden, as sacred as it is, I think if it was not deemed sacred, it would likely have been among the 2.5 million olive gardens or olive trees uprooted in Palestine since the expansion of the modern state of Israel. And I didn't know this at the time, but olive trees are a main source of livelihood for many Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. They're native to the region, they go back 7,000 years. And this Palestinian artist, who said this quote named Vivian Sansour, the olive tree is our oldest grandmother our eternal witness. But like I said, I didn't know at the time. I was just like a Christian tourist being like, oh, Jesus was here. Here's his tomb. And I mentioned this Christian tourist stuff because I think it highlights the stake that Christians have in the current genocide and oppression. Because in the narrative of these Christian pilgrimages or archaeological tours, have any of you done something like this, like go see the Holy Land, stuff like that? You know, what really matters in the land is just its connection to biblical times. What is sort of erased in these narratives, either implicitly or explicitly, is the past like 2,000 year history, really, of the people living on the land. They are either sort of ignored and not part of the frame, or they are literally built over, as in the case of the museum. And so in either photo, argue, though they seem very disparate, the lives of Palestinians are either raised through forms of Jewish Zionism or kind of implicit Christian Zionism. And so what does Zionism mean? It's an ideology that arose in the 19th century that favored the establishment of a Jewish nation state in the land we call Palestine. And I mention this specifically because I want to differentiate it from Judaism, which is many things, a religion, ethnicity, a peoplehood, a way of life. And it's so much more than Zionism, and I'm very grateful to anti-Zionist Jews in my life for embodying that. And that differentiation is particularly important to make in the context of a church, because obviously the church historically and presently has been responsible for like the bulk of the majority of anti-Semitism for centuries well before the Holocaust and the pogroms and stuff like that. And obviously it's been on the rise, and which is why in this sermon I want to specifically focus on Christian Zionism, which is Christian support for Zionism. And to give you a snapshot of it, let's go back to 2018. President Trump, if you remember this, made this controversial decision to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And this is controversial because Jerusalem is divided between Israeli and Palestinian territory, West and East Jerusalem. And so by this move, Trump was essentially supporting Israeli sovereignty over all of Jerusalem. And do you remember the headlines, like who he asked to do the benediction at the end of the ceremony unveiling or something like that? Some people are nodding. Some names that might be familiar to you are Robert Jeffress and John Hagee. Sorry, isn't his name. These are like two famous right-wing pastors and televangelists, one based in Texas, and another runs this huge lobbying Christian Zionist group called Christians United for Israel. Christians United for Israel has 10 million members. To put that in context, there are estimated 7.6 million Jews in America, which means there are more Christian Zionists in America than there are Jews in total. And then this kind of makes sense if you think about some Pew Research statistics in 2013, where twice as many white evangelical Protestants than Jews say that Israel was given to the Jewish people by God. And among Jews, 31% say the U.S. is not supportive enough of Israel. But in contrast, 46% of white evangelical Protestants say the same thing. So I hope you can see the kind of political complicity in some ways, that the U.S. most likely will not be sending $3.3 billion every year to Israel if it weren't for white evangelical Christian Zionists. So how did we get here? And so to do that, I'll do a very brief History 101 class, mostly relying on this book, Decolonizing Palestine Land, People, and the Bible by Palestinian Christian Reverend Mitri Raheb, who we're doing a book club starting this Wednesday, like a four-week series, and we'll be going through this book. So if this is interesting to you and want to learn a lot more, I would recommend starting this Wednesday night, so signing up. So for centuries, Palestine was under the Turkish Ottoman Empire, and then around the late 19th century, it starts to crumble. And European sort of nation states and empires start kind of salivating at their mouth, like who gets what territory, you know, Syria, Lebanon, blah, blah, blah. And Palestine, Britain ends up sort of vying for it. And one of the reasons is sort of a lobbying effort of British Christian Zionists. One of the most prominent ones is Lord Shaftesbury. I can't say his name. Is a prominent evangelical, and he proposes that Britain take over Palestine to establish a Jewish national home. And here is this quote. The soil and climate of Palestine are singularly adapted to the growth of produce required for the exigencies, that means demands, of Great Britain. capital and skill are alone required. So how does he define capital and skill? We're going to do some primary source reading. All right, next slide. You see the presence of a British officer, dot, 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 and Jews who will take themselves to agriculture in no other land. He concludes by kind of saying, the Turkish Empire is in rapid decay. The territory must be assigned to someone or another. There is a country without a nation and a nation without a country. His own once loved, nay, still loved people, the sons of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. So it's a lot in there, but I'll try to break it down with everyone. So I think you can see sort of, you know, it's really giving colonialism in like two major ways. The first line, the fertile soil and climate of Palestine, the ability to kind of see a land and say like, wow, ripe for profit for the British Empire. All we need is capital and skill. Let's like import that stuff, which, you know, is a familiar story for most of us familiar with the basic cursory of colonial history in the Americas, Africa, Asia, importing enslaved Africans or importing Chinese laborers. And what is missing from this vision? He spells out a lot of actors. What's missing are Palestinians, like the people, the Arabs on the land. They're sort of erased. It's just Olive Gardens, capital, and skill. And so the idea of a country without a nation is essential, or a land without people, that is an essential logic of settler colonialism. So Shaftesbury, his name sounds wrong. This dude's vision becomes reality after World War I. The Balfour Declaration, British Mandate on Palestine, 1920. And that time period is important because in 1905, Britain also passes a series of immigration laws barring Jewish immigration into Britain. Because people, Eastern European Jewish immigrants are coming from, fleeing the pogroms, and of course later on you have the Holocaust, and many nations around the world turn their back on Jewish refugees and divert them into Palestine. And so many Jewish refugees who come to Palestine weren't Zionists. They just really had nowhere else to go. And I mention all this because I think it's important to underscore the fact that the Holocaust and pogroms are really the problem of Europe and the US, but the people who are made to pay the price for it are Palestinians. And you can see then the anti-Semitic overtones of a Christian Zionist project. Let's send the Jews there so we don't have to deal with them here. And obviously it's completely legitimate to like seek refuge in a new land, establish a new home, it's a classic refugee thing. But it's another thing to do so in a way that displaces the original folks and creates an apartheid state where your group has rights and the other group doesn't. And that ends up being the Zionist project in Israel. So which brings us to 1948. You know, on that year, about 750,000 Palestinians are expelled from the lands thanks to the Israeli army during what, and the Arabic word for this is Nakba, or catastrophe. That's about 3 in 4 Palestinians who lose their homes, and some of them end up being kind of sequestered in Gaza, in the West Bank, and cities up north like Nazareth, or coming to countries in the Middle East or in America. Think of, some of you know Grace Dowd. She co-founded our queer ministry and is a core leader of Crown Heights Small Group. Her grandmother sort of fled overnight during the Nakba. She was telling me, Grace, that her grandma's house had this family tree on the wall going back hundreds of years. And lost all that and came to America. And Grace and people in her family have no right to go back, barred in some ways from going back and claiming her grandmother's land. But if you have proof of a Jewish grandparent, you can. You can claim Israeli citizenship, you can go back and buy land. And this pretty deep asymmetry is, at the heart of settler colonialism. And I've used the phrase now settler colonialism a few times. What does that mean? So there are many kinds of colonialism. Sorry, I'm a PhD student, so stop me from getting too nerdy. But settler colonialism is predominantly not about extracting resources or labor, although that is a big part of it, but it's predominantly about land takeover. It's about displacing peoples on the land and then building your own cities and towns and us kind of pretending they weren't there, rewriting history. Thus, the concept of terra nullius, or an empty land without people. And so, arguably, the logic of settler colonialism elevates land over people. And you can see this logic at work in these maps over time.
Some of you have seen it before, flare on the news, where the green territory represents Palestinian territory and the blue color represents Israeli territory. So Gaza is that strip on the left, that becomes a strip, and then on the right is the West Bank. And West Bank, you can't quite see, but it's slowly becoming like cottage cheese, because over 700,000 Israeli settlers have built kind of illegal settlements on the West Bank. But if you're a Palestinian living in the West Bank, settler colonialism is a big part of how you live your life. You have no, or West Bank or Gaza, you have no citizenship, no passport. So we know the city of Bethlehem where Jesus was born. It's a city in the West Bank. So if you're Mary and Joseph trying to head from Bethlehem back up to Nazareth, your hometown, to do so you would have to pass through a series of checkpoints that take hours and sometimes so long that dozens of women have given birth while waiting at these checkpoints. And there, you know, and if you live in the West Bank, there are people where you can bypass the checkpoints on special roads, but only Israelis can go through them. And so although Palestinians in the West Bank and what have you are essentially ruled by Israel, they have no vote in the national elections, so which is a somewhat familiar situation in American history. And if you live in Gaza, there are no checkpoints internally, but you can't leave. So essentially, it's sort of an open-air prison. It's been under a blockade since 2007 that has been so severe not even like notebooks can be imported in. And so, just to repeat, the logic of settler colonialism elevates land over people. And we see this at work also in American Christian ideologies. Here is Mike Pence, so this is a quote from Raheb's book. "In the story of the Jews, we have always seen the story of America. My country's very first settlers also saw themselves as pilgrims, sent by Providence to build a new promised land." So similarly to Schaff's guy, there's no mention of Native Americans, it's just land, pilgrims, and God. It's a sort of, we come in, this is land is ours, and so settler colonialism is a story that takes place all over the world. It has a unique name in Palestine called Zionism, but it's a familiar story. Now, of course, there are important differences between sort of the pilgrims that Pence referenced and Israeli settlers. Jews have a deep historical connection to the land of Israel. Many of them, like I said, were refugees. They had no choice of anywhere else to go. And so I think those are important issues to hold in mind. But I think the more important point is that the experiences of Palestinians, the experiences, let's say, of Native Americans, are structurally similar in that they both experience ongoing settler colonialism. Now, why am I harping on the settler colonial thingamajig? Why can't we just use other names? Am I just being like jargony? I'm harping on it because how we name a problem matters. So let's say I have a kid, and they come to me and they have like a bruised knee, and I ask them about it, and they're like, "Oh, I tripped and fell." They're like, "Okay, well, I'll get an ice pack." But if I talk a little bit more and I find out, "Oh, you didn't trip and fell, you were bullied," like, you know, I was thinking of particularly of Next Benedict, the Native kid in Oklahoma, then I'll get an ice pack, but obviously the ice pack is not really the full solution. I need to do a lot more. So if we say what's going on in Gaza is a humanitarian crisis, then the solution is humanitarian relief and violence. But if we say the problem is settler colonialism, then it's happening not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. And then the solution is land. And the question is, how do we give land back while at the same time creating a home for Israeli Jews and Palestinian Muslims and Christians? And I think that is, you know, obviously the big question. In this sermon, I will answer that question in the next 2 minutes. But and have the solution for world peace. But I do think it is an uncomfortable question for us as Americans to ask, because if we acknowledge that what's happening in Palestine is settler colonialism, and then we're like, oh, you know, end the occupation, we have to give land back, then we have to acknowledge that what's happening in America is also, has and continues to be settler colonialism, and with the grapple of ceding land back to Native nations. And if we do that, we have to think about also 40 acres and a mule, as promised to descendants of enslaved Africans. And so, in some ways, it's easier not to confront what's going on there, because then you don't have to confront what's going on here. In the last section, I want to think about theology, because you remember that quote from Lord Schaft. His name just gets shorter over the course of the sermon. somewhat appropriately named in some ways, is that his vision is not just a settler colonial vision, it's also a Christian vision. And I feel comfortable saying that. I think there are multiple Christianities. You know, he can be Christian, I can be Christian, whatever. So when he claims that the land of Palestine belongs to God's chosen people, you know, the Jews, he's writing in a specific theological moment. It's not coming out of nowhere. It's not just like a vision from an angel. In the mid to late 19th century, specific interpretations, literal interpretations of prophecies in the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, start becoming very popular. Prophecies that say that the Messiah will only come back once Jews return to Israel and establish a country, a nation state. Never mind, like, nation state as itself is a recent 19th century invention, but so these are all these hot takes that were going on, and these hot takes were saying that Israel is necessary for the return of the Messiah. So you see how these apocalyptic beliefs are essentially treat Jews as a means to an end. They're not for Jews, they are for Christians, which is like a familiar trope of the anti-Semitic connotations of Christian Zionism. But then the question, particularly if you're historically minded, is why did this interpretation become popular? Like, why did that hot take go viral, so to speak? And I'm going to quote my friend, Amir Marshi, from an upcoming op-ed he has. This theological development, and the technical term for it is premillenarian dispensationalism, but we'll just call it apocalyptic interpretations, was closely linked to a burgeoning desire to validate the Bible through archaeological and material evidence from the land of Palestine. These tenets, adapted and integrated into evangelism, became foundational for the emerging Christian fundamentalist movement. So this context is really important because it means that deconstructing Christian fundamentalism is inherent to deconstructing Christian Zionism. And I think Christian fundamentalism is something that if you come to Forefront a few times now, you've heard us talk about in different ways, about moving beyond sort of fundamentalist, literalist interpretations of scripture into interpretations that are more complex but also more liberatory. A founding pastor, Jonathan Williams, likes to say, we take scripture too seriously to take it literally. And so part of the work we try to do as a church is to embrace kind of mystery and faith instead of needing sort of empirical scientific certainty to believe it's all true. Like, we need to say, you know, the seven-day creation, and here is proof of Noah's Ark, and because of this, now I can believe in God and love and all that stuff. And so Christian fundamentalism provides kind of the infrastructure for Christian Zionism to reside on. And it's sort of, you know, no wonder we think about Jewish scholar Rachel Haverly talks about how in the 1950s in Israel, Prime Minister at that point, Ben-Gurion, would convene a Bible study group to talk about the book of Joshua and kind of reformulate the founding of the nation state of Israel through the language of the book of Joshua. Now, I'm not saying that's what was happening as Christian fundamentalists, but he was very much using and grappling with scripture. And so I think all this brings up from this quote from Rahab, which is, the land of Palestine is colonized by military hardware that is justified through theological software. Whether you're talking about Book of Daniel, Book of Revelations, Book of Joshua. And at this point, I'm just going to just ask a series of questions, because, you know, for we always say we're more interested in asking good questions than having good answers. Because, yeah, how do we make sense of the passages in Deuteronomy, in the Book of Joshua, or where, you know, God is essentially commanding Israelites to slaughter all living things, all peoples, children, to take over the land that he's given them? As Kwek Poulan, who's one of my favorite Asian feminist theologians, says, where is the promised land now? Can I believe in a God who killed the Canaanites or seems to have not have listened to the cry of Palestinians now for some 40 years? He's writing this in 1999. What do we do when the promised land is stolen land or confiscated land? How should we read the Bible through a decolonial lens through the eyes of the Canaanites, as some Native American scholars like Robert Allen Warrior have done, and maybe just discard the idea of a promised land altogether? Or is there something in that concept to be sort of salvaged, given how hopeful that concept has been for many, particularly Black Christians, thinking about liberation through the story of Exodus and singing about it as we do at church? And I think these are questions I don't have answers to. We just have to kind of work them out together as a church, maybe in this book club, maybe after service. And I just have some pointers, ways to kind of orient us, perhaps. Because maybe, you know, maybe we can salvage it and think about a promised land that is not tied to a nation state, that's not zero sum, but it is abundant, is, it has room and is flowing with milk and honey for all. Or maybe to think with abolitionist scholars and thinkers, we can think about how to keep ourselves safe outside of reliance on the police, military, on walls and borders. And so, you know, in Lent, what if we just give up faith in the state and put faith in each other? that's my anarchist call for Lent. But you know, it has obviously been very demoralizing to like open Instagram and see like very graphic images or Twitter and stuff like that. But I would say personally, what has been given me the most hope and energy has been just organizing with other people in this Forefront Palestine Task Force. Let me raise your hand if you're a part of it, so we can see. Yeah, it's like several folks. You'll see some of them on stage. Give them a hand. You're working really hard. And just yesterday someone dropped in the WhatsApp chat a recent poll that came out saying the majority of American Muslims, Christians, including evangelicals, and Jews favor a permanent ceasefire. None of this temporary pause stuff. But if hope feels far away in the promised land, maybe you just want to get rid of that, I offer you some words from Rabbi Miriam Grossman at her sermon at Kol Hayenu shortly after October 7th. She writes, and she spoke actually these words, "I don't have hope today, but maybe I don't need hope today, because today all I need to do is call Congress for a de-escalation and a ceasefire. And today I need to keep going even without hope, because hope will come one day. I make space for hope to come. I'm going to prepare her a beautiful room," kind of preparing, welcoming the bride of Shabbat. "And I set the table for her arrival through action, through not turning away." So how, if you're not feeling hopeful today, what if we set a table for hope? This is a QR code, which you're fine to pull up your phones if you wanna see and learn more about. We have a whole host of events coming up that the Palestine Task Force has organized. I mentioned the book club that's happening this Wednesday, where we're discussing the book, and it's about $20 online, but we have free copies of the book. We show up this Wednesday night, and I think it's been Crown Heights. Mitri Raheb will actually be in conversation with Poilon this on April 11th at Riverside Church, so all this information will be at this QR code. And there's a protest action WhatsApp group, many things going on. And as I mentioned, after service, we'll do a little circle and we'll talk more and you can learn more that way as well. And then a group of us will head from service to Viv's house in Crown Heights to do more, to eat lunch and pray and make protest posters together and read poetry, maybe Rev Rubin or something like that, which would be great. And the hope is that, you know, we come from so many parts of the world in this church. I hope we can build solidarity across sort of all our anti-imperial struggles, all struggles against police states, against genocides in the Congo and Sudan and what have you. And so it doesn't have to be zero sum. It doesn't have to be like, oh, why we're focused on Palestine, why we're not talking about Haiti. Like, we can talk about both together and learn from each other through this issue. And just my very last point is, as the second point I asked you to consider, is that I think we as Christians are uniquely privileged. If you're not Palestinian, we have a certain a capacity to speak up because we're not in fear of being surveilled like some of our Muslim siblings, and we're not also dealing, most of us, with like intense intergenerational trauma that's being triggered by, like, unlike our Jewish siblings. So I think there's a certain capacity and privilege we have to actually say and do something more. So we can start with prayer. Would you pray with me? God, you suffered with us under oppression by the state. For what is the cross but the ultimate sign of your solidarity? I ask that you help us live in solidarity with those who are persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but never destroyed, and work towards hope and abundance for all. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the Forefront Sermon Podcast. To learn more about Forefront and how we're ushering in the next 500 years of Christianity, visit forefrontchurch.com.